I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gina Puglisi. I'm the Vice President of the Premier Safety Institute, and welcome to the Governance 2010 conference, the breakout session on the business case for energy management, how to save millions and be green. And we're delighted to have today Al Neuner, the Associate Vice President for Geisinger Health System. Before I introduce Al, I'd like to tell you a little bit about Premier's energy program. It's part of our award-winning Green Healthy program, which includes our environmental purchasing as well as our Yes to Green corporate-wide green and sustainable program. And the third component of our Green Healthy program is our SPEER energy program, which stands for Securing Proven Healthcare Energy Reduction for the Ecosystem, and that's why we call it SPEER. Our goals for this program are to help our hospitals reduce their energy costs as well as their usage, and help them increase the use of cleaner and renewable energy, all to help them reduce their carbon footprint and ultimately greenhouse gas emissions that has a positive impact on public health. We're doing this through education of the leadership and through partnerships and collaborations so that our members can share their best practices. We also offer a competitive electronic energy procurement process in partnership with Practice Green Health, and this is to help our hospitals purchase renewable energy at a lower cost as well as traditional energy. The next slide talks about what we've been able to achieve with just the electronic energy procurement. We've been able to save our hospitals nearly $10 million, and this slide just shows some of the savings that the hospitals have had in purchasing energy. Mercy Health Partners, nearly $6 million. Covenant, $1.6 million. St. Luke's, $1 million. Ingalls, $800,000. And Excellus, $500,000. And as you can see, St. Luke's and Ingalls very recently have purchased a portion of their energy from renewable sources, and were able to get this at the same price as traditional energy. So this electronic procurement has been very successful in helping our hospitals buy energy from renewable sources without paying any extra for that. The next slide just shows our audio conference series, and what we have done with this series is structure to educate the leadership of healthcare to help them understand the support that's necessary to really get these energy efficient programs off the ground. Lots of our members sharing what they have been able to do. One of the programs is Geisinger, sharing more details about how they were able to save 3 million annually, even though they doubled their campus size. Catholic Healthcare West shared some information on their program on renewable energy with methane gas waste. St. Francis was able to show how they could cut their gas bills by 50% with all of their energy-efficient solutions, as well as becoming Energy Star Award winner. The next slide is a screenshot of our SPEER website, and this is located at premierinc.com/SPEER. This is a publicly accessible website as part of our Safety Institute web. And what we've assembled here is information, best practices, case studies, and tools, and educational programs that members or the public can download and help them with their energy efficiency programs. There's a number of detailed case studies, both on how to reduce energy use and become more efficient, as well as case studies on our electronic procurement using a reverse auction process. There are strategic energy management plans, as well as these downloadable energy audio conference series that I mentioned. You can download the audio files and the slides and other tools that go along with the program and listen to them at your leisure. We also have resources from some other organizations like ASHI and EPA and the Department of Energy, as well as a calculator from Practice Green Health to help you actually assess the impact of your energy use on public health in terms of the cost of health care related to the fossil fuels in the environment and respiratory illnesses. So you can actually quantify that and follow that over time. I'd now like to introduce our speaker this morning, Al Neuner. Al is a native of Nazareth, Pennsylvania, and he's received his mechanical engineering degree from Drexel University. He was for several years in the steel and air separation industry before he entered healthcare, and he's been at Geisinger since 1988. And Geisinger is an integrated health system with facilities dispersed across the 31-county service area in central and northeast Pennsylvania. And he's associate vice president for facility operations, and he has a staff of 200 that serve as a physical plant of nearly 4 million square feet. Their main campus is in Danville, and they've been very creative in managing their energy resources and able to achieve significant energy savings despite expanding their plant more than 50%. He's won numerous awards for his achievements, and we are absolutely delighted to have him here today. So please join me in welcoming Al Nooner to share his journey on energy efficiency and his saving dollars in the process.
I think what Gina said pretty well sums it up. We've grown substantially since then. We're now well over 5 million square feet, but that's really pretty small compared to the previous presentation when I hear Cleveland Clinic with 40,000 employees and Catholic Health West with 54,000. Geisinger is a pretty small system at 13,000. But we do a lot of good things, and we're going to talk about the energy side of what we've been doing. So basically, we're going to paint the picture of what we've accomplished, some examples of projects that got us there, different ways to finance these, because that's always the big issue with hospital management and CFO, some conclusions and time for questions. The overall picture is that in 1989, we installed a new 69,000-volt substation, and that was my first project at Geisinger. I sized it at 10 megawatts. The very first summer we were on it, I nearly panicked because we hit an electrical demand of 8.5 megawatts. And I thought, oh, my God, we've got OR additions coming up. We've got new buildings. They're going to kill me because we're going to outgrow this substation. So I really needed to come up with a strategy that would, not make me look bad. I'd like to say I was prophetic in my environmental responsibility in 1989. I was not. This was merely started as an exercise in self-preservation. Okay, but since that time, the main campus has grown from 1.2 to 2.1 million square feet, growth of about 80%. At that point in time, we had no electric chillers. All our cooling was steam-driven absorbers. And we had virtually, when I started there, I don't think there was 300 PCs on campus. Okay? We now, with our full electronic medical record and everything else, have over 8,000 PCs just on that campus. So, the net bottom line is that our demand today is still 8.5 megawatts. Okay, so if you account for the growth in the campus, that translates to a 43% reduction in electricity usage, which accounts to over $4 million annually in electrical savings, natural gas savings of about $1 million annually. And the story there is when I started in 1988, our peak steam demand was 42,000 pounds per hour. We've since doubled the size of the campus, and our peak steam demand today is about 38,000 pounds per hour with adding all that square footage. We've taken the money that we've saved, and we actually annually reinvest that. All right, so that $5 million in savings comes back as a facilities infrastructure renewal fund so that we can keep doing more good things. And, as a side note, we also reduced our water usage by about 25 million gallons annually. In fact, it's to the point that the borough came to me about 2 months ago and said, you got to use more water. I said, what are you talking about? He says, well, we rely on you as a source of revenue. Realize Geisinger sits in a town of 5,000 people, okay, that the campus is literally bigger than the town. And, they're having real problems because their revenue of selling us water has decreased $50,000 a year based on our reduction in usage. But just graphically, you can see the lower line is our demand in kilowatts. The upper line is the growth in square footage. Now, I will tell you that the upper line is divided by 100, so that slope is greatly decreased. But to get it all on one slide... So you'll see the demand is reasonably steady. periods of decline. We'll talk about those. If we translate it to energy use per square foot, you'll see we're at about 6.8 watts per square foot in 1989, and today we're just over 3. I did a quick calculation sitting in the other presentation. This room is about 800 square feet. There's 2,400 watts of lighting in here. So our electrical demand for the entire campus is equivalent to this room, and this is the lighting in here is not including the air conditioning and everything else that supports this space. So our hospital is more efficient than this room we're in, generally driven by the lighting type they chose. How this translates to ecology, to green, is best demonstrated on the Practice Green Health website, okay, where you can actually put in your electrical usage and translate that into the tons of pollutants that are emitted at the power plants to serve you. But it also takes it a step further and translates that energy usage into direct medical costs and societal value, okay? So you'll see here that, you know, at this level of energy usage, which is where we would have been had we stayed on our course of 6.8 watts per square foot at our current square footage of 2.1 million, that in essence alleviated, 1.6 premature deaths per million population and all these other things, okay? Asthma attacks of 1,600. So then we look at the case where we are now. This is our actual electricity usage for a year. But more importantly, if we compare those two, okay, we'll show a savings here of $4.6 million in electricity versus our original path and 42,000 tons of CO2 generation. Okay, significant number. And again, all the other things that went with that. The equivalent of that is, pick one, taking 7,000 cars off the road, planting 3 million trees, or actually serving our community of 5,000 homes. The next step that's in place now, we were just in November awarded American Reinvestment and Recovery Act grant of $2.25 million to install cogeneration. The reason that's important is because it will reduce our carbon emissions another 16,000 tons per year. So in other words, we will be at a carbon emission rate that is one quarter of where we would have been had we not implemented a program. And then also all these other pollutants that go with that. The reason that's possible is because when you buy electricity from the utility, that entire process is only about 32% efficient. All right. So for every BTU put in the power plant, only 32% of that gets out to a customer. The rest is lost in the cooling towers you'll see at the power plant because all the heat is wasted. With an on-site cogeneration plant, we utilize that heat to take one of our boilers offline. So that process efficiency goes up to 80%, which results in that savings of CO2 per year. Okay, it's strictly a process efficiency issue. Some very basic things we did that hopefully everyone in here has done is to upgrade light fixtures. I used the example in this room, this is extremely inefficient. They're all incandescent. When we did that, we reduced our demand by 1 megawatt. And in fact, on the graph, you saw there was 1 year where that just dropped down. We saw that in the bill, and that savings was 1 megawatt. For an annual cost of about $460,000 a year that we saved monetarily. We did that as a kind of a pioneering effort as an operating lease. At that time, I did not have facilities infrastructure funding in place. This was one of the projects that got me there. And to get this work done, I knew if I couldn't rely on the health system for a funding source, I needed to develop my own. So we did this as an operating lease. So during the 7 years of the lease, we had a net income of $160,000 a year, which was a savings minus a lease payment. And then after year seven, we, of course, enjoy the $300,000 a year annually now. Cooling systems. I'm not going to talk specifically about absorbers or chillers or all those other things, but cooling systems, you know, the way you make your cooling, and depends whether you're in the south or the north, what kind of climate, but can account for 20% of all your energy usage. These are extremely energy-intensive machines. We were operating machines that were costing 9 cents a ton to produce cooling. A ton is 12,000 British thermal units per hour. And replacing that with a much more efficient chiller that costs, you know, 6 cents less per ton. Realize that in most hospitals you have thousands of tons of cooling operating for 4,000 or 5,000 hours a year. So that change of equipment alone yields us savings of about $360,000 a year. Even if you have cooling equipment that's maybe 10 or 15 years old, by changing it out, there are, you know, the new equipment is so much more efficient that there are savings to be had. Cooling towers. Cooling is a mechanical process. Its efficiency is dependent upon the temperature that you reject heat to. And by essentially oversizing cooling towers and lowering the temperature that they discharge at, for every degree that you lower that temperature of the water coming back to the chiller, you save 2% of energy. Standard design on any cooling system, you know, from a mechanical MEP firm, is usually 12-degree approach. So by taking that to a 5-degree approach, by adding additional towers, that's a savings of about 15% on the chillers. Okay, so that's another $40,000 annually. VFDs, most older hospitals, anything over 15, 20 years old, would have has all constant volume systems, whether it's air exchanges, you know, the air going into the rooms, the air handlers, whether it's pumping systems, whether it's fans. And we don't need the same amount of cooling all the time. We don't need the same amount of medical air, output flow. We don't need the same amount of domestic water if we're pumping that. So by installing variable speed drives to mirror the performance of the pumping device or whatever the mechanical device is to the actual usage required, we can save significant amounts of energy. You'll see some examples here on the left. A constant volume system, regardless of flow, always consumes 100% of its power. So if it's a 100-horsepower motor, that's its energy consumption. However, on a VFD, at 50% of the flow, we're actually only at 12% of the electrical power draw. All right, so these the power reduction is the cube of the flow reduction. Okay, on a VFD drive. So significant savings in converting all these systems. Waterside economizer, depending upon your climate. We make cooling about 1,500 hours a year without running a chiller. We run water through our cooling towers. We then just merely run it through a heat exchanger and directly cool the building chilled water with that heat exchanger. So taking a chiller offline, which can cost hundreds of dollars per hour to operate, saves us a significant amount of money. We have this on every cooling system on every major campus. Condensate recovery. A big portion of that water reduction savings is actually reuse. We take all the condensate from our air handlers. You know, whether you have an air conditioner in your home or in your car, when you run it, there's water runs out somewhere. All right, that's the effect of air conditioning. You're condensing the moisture out of the air. We actually recapture all that water and pump it back to our cooling towers because cooling towers work by evaporating water. Okay, so that just about eliminates all the water makeup for cooling towers. The other beauty of this is it's absolutely pure water. All right, there's no hardness to it. There's no minerals in it. It's cool. You know, the water is already cold, which is good for the cooling towers. Plus, we generate this when we're running our cooling systems the hardest. All right, so very simple thing to do. It costs about a couple hundred bucks per air handler. It's just a little spill containment pallet with a little sump pump in it. Okay? Tie those all together, pump it to the towers, and it's just a natural solution. Medical air. This system's a bit unique in that we don't. There's no dryers. Typically, in a medical air system, you've got desk and dryers to purge the moisture back out of them. You've got air that you waste, about 15%. You also have to heat them to drive the moisture out. In this system, we use a heat of compression from the compressor, so there's no additional heat purchased. And also the purge air goes back into the first stage of the compressor and then is knocked out by the intercooler. So a much more efficient device, probably about 30% more efficient than a typical medical air system. And with our large systems, we're saving about $20,000 annually on those. Powerhouse. We did a burner retrofit, even though we've got older boilers. They were in great shape. This project paid for itself in the first year. Of course, the savings here are absolutely dependent upon natural gas costs, which can range anywhere from $5 to $15 per MCF. These savings at the time we did it were based on about $4 gas. So as gas increases, obviously costs, the savings actually go up with that. But been a great system for us. We struggle when we were looking at the boilers. And what we do is every time we tackle a project, we try to touch every system around it so that we don't have to come back for the next 10 years or so. And so as we were doing the boiler project, we thought, how do we recover all the heat from the blowdown? Because on boilers, you know, since you're evaporating water, you've got minerals. That mineral concentration builds up, and you have to lose water to bring fresh in to knock that concentration down, the hardness. And then we finally came to the conclusion, well, why do we blow down? You know, if we make ultra-pure water, there's no reason to blow a boiler down. So we invested about $20,000 in an RO system, some plastic storage tanks so we could meet surge demands, and we now have no blowdown in our boilers, so we don't have to worry about the heat we're losing down a drain, which, you know, when you blow down a boiler, you're blowing down 300-degree water. And a lot of heat loss, plus you have to replace the water. You have to buy the water to make it up. So very simple, going back to basics, eliminating the problem totally, and obviously generating savings and better boiler performance. Steam trap monitoring, tremendous waste in a lot of large facilities because these things are all over. When they don't function properly, a lot of steam is wasted in the building, comes back in the condensate stream. The interesting story that goes with this is my plumbers actually were pushing to get this done. We spent the money, installed the system, and I would walk into an equipment room and I'd see the lights lit up orange, which is not good. And it's like, okay, you know, we spent this money, but I still have traps blowing by. All right. In other words, they're passing steam. They shouldn't pass steam. And so in a department meeting, I said, look, you know, I invested in this because you wanted me to. I need the savings. I'm either going to get it by you using this or I'm going to have to lay off a plumber. Okay. Compliance has been great. Okay. So really got the message there, kind of an alternate way to do it, but was effective. We installed last year chilled water storage. We now have this slated for two additional campuses, several benefits. Number one, right now in Danville, this facility went in with a 330,000 square foot building that we just had the ribbon cutting last week. But we were able to add that kind of square footage without adding any cooling equipment. So we did not buy a chiller, all right? By not buying a chiller and its associated pumping, cooling towers, and everything else, paid for the tank, all right? So what this allows us to do is at night, when our electricity rates are about two-thirds of what they are during the day, we make our cooling at night. And it's actually kind of scary with the size facility we have to walk in there in the heart of the day and nothing's running, you know, because we're running off the tank. The other benefit in this is it allows us to participate in demand response programs where we get paid roughly $50,000 a year per megawatt that we enroll. All right, so right now we're getting $4,000 a month because if I get a phone call from PJM, I can turn off my chillers at any point and reduce my load. Also at night, the temperatures, if you recall about cooling towers, chiller efficiency is very dependent upon the temperature outside, the wet bulb temperature. Well, that's lower at night. So by making my cooling at night, we're much more efficient. We use much less electricity, and that electricity is at a lower cost. Okay? So, you know, this has worked out so well. We've got two other sites we're going to be adding this to as we grow those sites instead of adding chillers. It also limits the amount of electrical demand. You know, obviously, if I'm not installing a chiller, I'm not increasing my need to upsize a substation, cabling, any other infrastructure on campus. UPS systems. I'm sure you all have them. I'm pretty positive from most places I know that you have one dedicated every time you put in a cath lab or a CAT scanner, because when you're dealing with Philips or Siemens, they say, well, you need power conditioning. And so they sell you a UPS to go with that installation. We've taken a different approach. First of all, we have central UPS as a utility. Each CAT scanner, MRI, any of those imaging devices you install are roughly 250 to 300 kW load. However, they only take that power for microseconds, extremely short bursts when you're doing imaging. What we've done is install a centralized 900 kVA UPS unit. We have currently all our imaging, our ORs, and outlets on every inpatient floor connected to it. We've got over just about 5 megawatts of connected load. Okay? But because the imaging takes so little, you know, such short bursts of power, no two devices hit at the same time. So because of that diversity, this machine's only even loaded at about 20%. The other aspects of this is that when you have battery UPSs and double conversion, and I'm not going to try to explain that to you, this is a much more efficient machine in that it doesn't require air conditioning, and it really relies on kinetic energy. We spin a flywheel up to about 7,500 RPM, and then it turns into a generator upon loss of power to supply all those devices. So really the big savings here is in not buying the other UPSs, because a normal UPS for a 300 kVA unit would run between probably around $100,000 to $150,000. So by just having one, we avoid that for, and I think we've got about 20 imaging devices attached to this. Talk a little bit about LEEDS. LEEDS has made my job a lot easier. And actually, I want to talk a little bit about this building, you know, just to demonstrate what wise investment in infrastructure can do for you. This is our 70,000-square-foot research facility. It's called the Hood Center for Health Research. Our electrical usage for the campus went down when we added this building. You think, now, how can that be? What happened, there was a chiller plant in the basement of the research building next to it. And as part of the project, I mean, I had to fund this portion. I said, look, we have 20-year-old chillers. You know, if we put in more efficient equipment with the new building, we can retire those, and, you know, it'll be better off for all of us in the long run. Of course, at the time, I was fighting budget cuts on the building project where they just wanted, let's just put in rooftops. It's cheap. We can save money. So I kicked about $1 million into the project that I transferred from my infrastructure funding. And in essence, the net savings from the chillers was greater than the energy use of this building. Now, it's a very efficient building because this entire face you're looking at there is facing south. So that's all glass. We got a lot of natural light in the building, a lot of heating in the winter. And it's got an extremely efficient lighting system. But, you know, the net effect was that we reduced our campus energy load when we brought this online. It was just astounding when we did the figures afterwards to try to see what we had accomplished. Geisinger has taken the approach that every building we build will be LEED certified. All right, so far, We've got four buildings certified in the last, actually only about 2 years. We've got four that are actually built and occupied now that are under the certification process. I think we're expecting at least silver on all four. But it's a great process in that what we see is that over normal design, energy usage in these buildings is about 32% less, all right, than what normal energy efficiency would be by code, all right? So that helps us all in the long run. Financing. I've put these in here. There's actually another one I'll talk about in order of preference. Obviously, self-funded is the best. As healthcare organizations, we all generally have pretty good bond rates. You know, Geisinger is a AA bond rated company, or there's a AA rating on its bonds. So if we can use that money, which we typically do, that's our lowest cost of capital. That'll carry an interest rate of maybe 3.5%, 4%. Okay. Next is an operating lease. That may be going by the wayside. There's discussions now within FASB which to actually eliminate operating leases. We'll see where that goes. Obviously, that's a little bit higher interest rate because now we're doing external financing. You know, so somebody else has got to make money on top of our rating. And there's a chance that it may require a payment to buy the equipment at the end of the lease. Okay, so that would be the next choice. Performance contract is something I'm sure some people knock on your door and say, hey, you know, we can save you energy and we'll fund it and all this stuff and we'll guarantee it. Well, really what a performance contract is, it's nothing more than an operating lease with an insurance policy. So this is another adder onto your interest rate, all right, because someone is insuring the results. Also, it carries a higher capital cost because it requires engineering documentation and measurement up front, as well as after that, of course, you have to pay for. Okay. So while they work and they may be suitable for some projects if you have no other alternative, they are not suitable also for other projects. A good example would be lighting. You know, if I change out a fixture that consumes 100 watts to one that consumes 50 watts, the risk is zero. I mean, I have to save 50 watts. All right. So to buy a performance contract to guarantee that and pay the insurance on it, you know, makes no financial sense. Power purchase agreements are becoming very popular. They're actually replacing another form of financing, which we'll talk about. And it's mostly at this point in time being used for green technologies. In other words, a few people may approach you and say, look, we'd like to build a solar farm or a wind farm, and if you'll agree to purchase power from us for 20 years at this price, you know, we'll have a deal. And then, of course, the developer takes that, and he's got these commitments, and now he can go get financing to build the deal. They've got their place. I'm not sure. You know, obviously, as we go down, the cost of these devices gets higher. All right, so you're locking yourself in for a 20-year agreement that is probably going to be pretty pricey to buy these renewable resources. Kind of a switch on this is where you can actually sell your power-consuming devices like your powerhouse or your chiller plant, get an upfront capital payment, and then the company that buys it will do the upgrades to it. All right, but again, you're paying somebody else's profit and all those things, so it's a higher cost to you to do that. But, I mean, if you're absolutely starved for capital and you have a desperate need for a new power plant or something, it might be a viable option. But realize that it's costing you more in the long run. Conclusions. You know, we're very convinced that, you know, we've done the right thing by in a planned approach. I mean, this is not a two-year program or anything else. This has been going on now for close to 20 years. The net effects of what we've done is once we get the cogen on, we'll have reduced our CO2 emission rate per square foot by 80%. We've got annual savings of around $5 million. Now, I got to tell you, in January 1st, rate caps came off in Pennsylvania. These numbers are all based on 6 cents a kilowatt hour. our actual cost of power right now is about between 8 and 9. All right, so you know, it has mitigated the effect. But, I mean, think of what that effect would have been had we not done any of this work. I mean, we'd be talking about $20 million. Through all this, you know, we operate on our campus not only a 69,000-volt substation, but we've got two backup supplies, which are only good to 10 megawatt. And once we outgrow that, we've got a substantial investment to make with the utility to bring larger backup size line, larger backup lines into us. So we've deferred that whole investment, which might be $3 to $4 million. And then actually on all the money we spent, we've got an average return on investment of about 3 years. While some projects are 1 year, some are five, the net result is they average out about 3 years across the board. Sister talked a little bit about this. There's other things to being green, other benefits. The things that we see, employees are excited about this kind of thing. Obviously, as we maintain our equipment, replace it with new, more efficient stuff, we reduce our operating and maintenance costs. We've got increased customer comfort. We've increased the asset value of our plant and an enhanced public image because we do get a lot of PR on all these things. And that's the building we just actually ribbon cut last week. Just briefly tell you a little bit about it. It's a bit different in that we're using the model of a universal room in which once a patient is admitted, they don't move to another unit or another floor. So if you come in as an ICU patient, instead of going to step down or med surg or whatever, as you get a little better, the nursing staff just flexes around you and all the equipment flexes around you. So once you're admitted, you stay in the same room. So thank you for attending. I hope you any questions I can answer.
Could you tell us a little more about this? What kind of furnishings, how it's laid out?
Sure. The top two floors of the building are inpatient rooms. There are 60 inpatient rooms in this tower. There's 12 ORs, actually only four are opening currently, with eight more to come. The room furnishing, I mean, we've got sleep-in for family right in the room, so like the chair opens up into a bed. Every room is set up, obviously, if we're doing all levels of care in every room's an ICU room down to whatever. It features a lot of wood. It's got a lot of wood look floor. It's very patient friendly. The rooms are, because of the way we have to staff it nursing wise, they're glass on the front with the nursing station right there. The other interesting thing with this is totally EICU equipped. We're rural, but what we're doing now, I mean, even though at this site, we've got residents, and we're fully staffed around the clock for our ICUs for physicians. We have a team in a remote building, and there's a camera in each room, a microphone, and they're doing nothing more than looking at all the monitors. In other words, an ICU nurse has two patients, and she's over here doing this. She might miss something, even though it may not trip an alarm. So we've got physician and nursing staff in a remote location constantly monitoring all those monitors, as well as they can communicate with the patient and the doctor that's in the room. And then, of course, we're rolling this out to other rural hospitals who don't have round-the-clock physician staffing necessarily for their ICUs, so we can enhance their care. So that's the exciting part about what's going on here.
And what kind of lighting do you have in
there? It's mostly T5. It's all fluorescent. We haven't used any incandescent lighting in 12 years or so.
Do you have much LED lighting?
Not yet. There's not a whole lot of fixtures available. I mean, we have LED lighting. We use it in signage. This whole actual building facade is lit by LEDs, but fixtures for in normal use are not widely available yet. Yeah, this has daylighting, what they call daylight savings. So as the light levels in the room increase, the lighting will dim, so that you have the same light level in the room. Any other questions? Yeah.
Ever since you talked at the beginning about calculating this room,
mm-hmm.
I'm fixated on that. So if you were to redo this room just for the lighting only,
mm-hmm.
what would it be to get ergonomically correct?
Well, it'd be fluorescent instead of
it. What would the decrease in energy usage be? What percent would that decrease?
Well, normally, I mean, this room is lit at about 3 watts per square foot is the energy intensity to provide what you see here. We can provide the same level of lighting in here for less than a watt per square foot. So we could reduce the energy consumption just in the lighting systems in here by at least 60%, two-thirds, with a fluorescent solution. Yeah, there'd be less, be a different style fixture. I mean, you can do compact fluorescence in these cans. They're called can fixtures. You know, these are 100-watt lamps, and there's a lot of them. And actually, I didn't count the ones in the coves back there. Yeah. But, yeah, there's other lighting solutions. You know, like I would put strip lighting. You know, instead of that cove lighting, it would be actually GE makes a real nice LED strip that would serve the same function. So, yeah, significant. If your hospital or institutions haven't done lighting, that is the absolute first thing to do because it's a zero risk. I mean, and what's nice about all these projects, I mean, when you look at this, you know, realize hospitals make about, let's say, a 4% return on investment. You know, your bottom line at the end of everything is about 4%. What I like to do is take that and turn around. If I have a $100,000 energy project, that's the equivalent of 25 times that 100,000. Okay, so that's the equivalent of $2.5 million revenue stream. You know, so now look at 5 million. That's the equivalent of $100 million of new revenue. Okay, and that sometimes makes it easier to get the board's and the CFO's attention. You know, when you because they think in terms of revenue. Yeah, they're bigger numbers, and it. You know, hospital finance people, I've learned, are more focused on revenue than they are, you know, savings. I mean, energy savings come right off the bottom line. So it's true savings at low risk. So, other questions? Yep, absolutely. Yeah, I'm sorry. The question is, if we change the incandescent lighting out, could we dim it? And yes, in the Center for Health Research, that's all a lot of conference rooms and things where you want dimming. And yes, there are now dimmable ballasts. They weren't available maybe 5 years ago, but today we can do all those things. Other questions? Thank you so much for attending this rather than my CEO's presentation down the hall. Didn't know he was coming until I ran into him last night at the cocktail hour.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Really.